Welcome to the inaugural Collaborative Group of the Americas for Inherited Gastrointestinal Cancer podcast series. This series is presented by the CGA Education Committee. This year's series will focus on the multidisciplinary, patient-centered approach to management of Lynch syndrome. The aim of this series is to hear from experts about how they counsel their patients on cancer risk reduction strategies in Lynch syndrome.
My name is Catherine Germansky, and I will be hosting today's podcast. I'm a gastroenterologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and director of the GI Cancer Genetics and Prevention Program. Please note that the content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you have regarding a medical condition. Today's podcast will take a closer look at issues surrounding family planning, gynecologic cancer risk, and management strategies, including risk-reducing gynecologic surgeries in women with Lynch syndrome. We are here with Dr. Leslie Garrett, who is the director of the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Dr. Garrett, thank you so much for speaking with us today. So let's start with a couple of questions. For women diagnosed with Lynch syndrome, the lifetime risks of gynecologic cancers are significant. How do you discuss these risks with your Lynch syndrome patients?
Great question, and thank you, Katie, for inviting me to speak with you today. While much of the focus and research surrounding Lynch syndrome is regarding colorectal cancers, it is imperative to remember that women with Lynch carry the same or greater lifetime risk of developing endometrial cancer. In women with Lynch syndrome, the lifetime risk of developing endometrial cancer is up to 70%. Compared to 3% in the general population. Endometrial cancer is also found to develop in younger women compared to the general population, with an average age of diagnosis being 50 compared to 60 in non-Lynch syndrome patients. The lifetime risk of developing ovarian cancer, fortunately, is much smaller, with Lynch syndrome patients developing ovarian cancer in approximately 3 to 20%, compared to 1.5 in the general population.
Does the patient's genotype or family history influence your discussion about lifetime risk estimates?
Interesting. Studies to date have shown increased lifetime risk of endometrial cancers in all genotypes, with the highest found in MLH1, MSH2, and MSH6. Ovarian cancer risk appears to be the highest in those with MLH1 or MSH2 mutations, and there is limited data on ovarian cancer risk with MSH6 and PMS2. Despite these differences, however, there is controversy surrounding whether our recommendations should be altered based on mutation-specific risk. And therefore, in general, we try to remain consistent in recommendations, recognizing that there may be clinical scenarios, including a patient's family history or anxiety regarding surgical menopause, which may make delaying removal of the tubes and ovaries make more sense.
How do you factor in non-malignant gynecologic conditions into your overall risk assessment?
The presence of non-malignant GYN conditions such as ovarian cysts, endometriosis, or adenomyosis does not appear to alter risk differently in Lynch syndrome patients compared to the general population, but may enter into the discussion regarding additional benefits of surgical intervention.
So what do you tell at-risk women to watch out for in terms of symptoms of both endometrial and ovarian cancers?
Most endometrial cancers are detected due to abnormal uterine bleeding, and therefore recognizing this and prompt reporting is essential to early detection. Unlike endometrial cancers, most ovarian cancers are discovered at a later stage due to the presence of silent symptoms when the disease is at an earlier stage. Data from case control studies show that women with Lynch syndrome are more likely to have stage 1 or 2 disease than in the general population. However, there does not appear to be difference in 5-year overall survival rates. It is important that women are taught to recognize symptoms that may be associated with the development of ovarian cancer, such as bloating, abdominal or pelvic pain, increased abdominal girth, difficulty eating, early satiety, or changes in their bowel or bladder habits. Symptoms that persist for more than 1 to 2 weeks are a change from the woman's baseline, should be reported to their doctor, and should prompt imaging with a pelvic ultrasound or a CT.
Risk-reducing hysterectomy and bilateral esophageal oophorectomy is the core management strategy for female Lynch syndrome patients. Can you describe to us the conversations that you have with your patients regarding these prophylactic risk-reducing surgeries?
So risk-reducing hysterectomy and bilateral esophageal oophorectomy, or BSO, appear to be effective in preventing endometrial and ovarian cancers in patients with Lynch syndrome. In one of the largest cohort studies to date, there were no endometrial cancers in women who underwent prophylactic hysterectomy compared to controls. Timing of the hysterectomy and the BSO is based on whether childbearing is complete, as well as menopausal status, comorbidities, and surgical history, family history, and somewhat on genotype. In general, we typically say the surgery should be considered by age 35 to 40 or when done with childbearing. It should consist of removing the uterus, the cervix, both fallopian tubes, and ovaries. This surgery can be performed laparoscopically in most cases, unless there are patient or uterine factors that prohibit a minimally invasive approach.
Anecdotally, there is the rare patient who develops a peritoneal malignancy after bilateral esophageal oophorectomy. Are we counseling correctly when we advise that risk-reducing hysterectomy with bilateral esophageal oophorectomy offers maximal risk reduction?
Peritoneal cancers following BSO are seen in both BRCA carriers as well as Lynch syndrome patients. Approximately 1% of BRCA patients will develop peritoneal cancers following removal of their tubes and ovaries, and there have been two reports of women with Lynch syndrome developing peritoneal cancers 8 and 12 years following removal of the tubes and ovaries. These are rare events, and while patients should be made aware of this possibility and the symptoms which could occur if peritoneal cancer develops, which are basically similar to the ovarian cancer symptoms, there are no guidelines on how to monitor these women. In general, I advise them to have annual gynecologic exams even after their risk-reducing hysterectomy and BSO.
As with any patient who plans to undergo a surgical procedure, it is, of course, important that she understands the risks, benefits, and alternatives. What do you review with your patients during your consult visit prior to their procedure?
In general, hysterectomy and bilateral esophageal oophorectomy are low-risk procedures, but do carry the risk of bleeding, infection, blood clots, or damage to surrounding structures such as the bladder, bowel, ureters, blood vessels, or nerves. Long-term risks of surgical menopause include an increase in long-term mortality and cardiovascular risks. Surgical menopause also appears to have deleterious effects on the risks for cognitive decline, Parkinsonism, depression and anxiety, glaucoma, sexual dysfunction, and osteoporotic fractures. Estrogen replacement, luckily, appears to negate some of these effects and therefore can be started postoperatively and weaned off at the time of typical menopause, which for most is around the age of 50.
You raise a great topic for discussion. Estrogens are commonly used in women after prophylactic surgery, including bilateral esophageal oophorectomy. How do you discuss their use in patients with Lynch syndrome specifically?
The safety of postmenopausal hormonal therapy in women with hereditary syndromes is controversial. The main concern regarding the use of such therapy in this patient population is the potential for increasing the risk of breast cancer, especially in women with BRCA mutations. This is even more of a question given the controversial and potentially increased risk of breast cancer in women with Lynch syndrome.
Are there other options for premenopausal women who desire risk reduction but are trying to avoid a surgical menopause?
Delay of removing the ovaries or considering a stepwise procedure with removing the uterus first as well as the fallopian tubes when complete with childbearing, and then removing the ovaries once menopausal can be considered in patients who prioritize avoiding the risk of surgical menopause over those of cancer risk reduction.
What pre-surgical discussions do you have with your patients regarding quality of life issues after prophylactic gynecologic surgery?
The benefit of surgery is the relief it provides from cancer risk reduction. In some women with other gynecologic issues, such as endometriosis or chronic pelvic pain, surgery may also provide symptom relief from painful periods, heavy bleeding, pain with sexual intercourse. However, in women who are completely asymptomatic and premenopausal, there may be significant changes that affect the quality of life and sexual function as estrogen levels decline. Again, most of these can be avoided by placing the women on a short course of low-dose estrogen following surgery.
So what are your patients' major surgical concerns and your recommendations to address them?
Women tend to worry that everything will fall out after a hysterectomy. In general, the risk of future prolapse appears to be highest when hysterectomy is performed in women with pre-existing prolapse, while the risk in women with normal pelvic support is less clear. In general, using techniques that incorporate existing pelvic support to close the vagina, post-hysterectomy pelvic organ prolapse is rare. However, if a patient's bladder or vagina was predisposed to prolapse, prolapse will occur whether or not a hysterectomy was performed. Another worry is with sexual function. Again, this is very mixed in terms of patient experience. For women with non-cancer GYN pathology, such as fibroids, endometriosis, or heavy irregular bleeding, surgery typically leads to an improvement in sexual health. In some women undergoing hysterectomy, changes to the vaginal canal may lead to discomfort during penetrative intercourse, but again, this is rare. Lack of estrogen can affect the health and integrity of the vaginal mucosa, leading to irritation and dryness in general and in with intercourse. Vaginal lubrication and moisturizers can help, as well as topical vaginal estrogen.
Are there non-surgical approaches to risk reduction that you can offer to women, such as chemo prevention?
There's limited data regarding chemo prevention for GYN malignancies in women with Lynch syndrome. Studies have shown that many risk factors and protective factors present in the general population also exist in GYN cancer risk for women with Lynch syndrome. For example, in a woman with Lynch syndrome, risk factors for the development of endometrial cancer seem to be the same hormonal risk factors, aka an increase in unopposed estrogen from high BMI or exogenous estrogen use, as in the general population. Later age at menarche, higher parity, and longer use of oral contraceptive pills have also been associated with a lower risk of endometrial cancer in patients with Lynch syndrome. Birth control or oral contraception use in the general population demonstrates a 50% risk reduction in the risk of endometrial and ovarian cancer. In BRCA patients, use of combined oral contraceptives resulted in a decreased risk of ovarian and fallopian tube cancers. This reduction increased with the duration of use. Moreover, there did not appear to be an increased risk of breast cancer in BRCA patients with prolonged OCP use. The optimal formulation of which birth control pill to use, various strengths of estrogen and progesterone, is unknown.
Women who have not yet completed childbearing or those who defer surgery often desire surveillance for endometrial and ovarian cancers. Unfortunately, there is no screening test proven effective for gynecologic cancers in Lynch syndrome. In addition, endometrial cancer screening guidelines have changed over time, with seemingly less importance placed on endometrial biopsy. How do you approach these topics with our patients?
I agree with you. The benefit of surveillance strategies has been a bit of a moving target. While endometrial biopsy has never proven to be of benefit in Lynch syndrome patients, the test is highly sensitive and specific as a diagnostic procedure. Annual endometrial biopsies in asymptomatic women starting at age 30 to 35, or 5 to 10 years prior to the earliest age of first diagnosis of Lynch-associated cancer of any kind in a family, can be considered. However, patient education surrounding recognizing and reporting concerning symptoms such as postmenopausal bleeding or dysfunctional uterine bleeding appears to be the most effective way to promote early endometrial cancer detection. A patient's experience with endometrial biopsy can vary. Most women who have had children are more tolerant, but in general, it is a procedure which can be done in the office. While it is fairly well tolerated in most women, it can lead to a short period of cramping and mild to moderate pelvic pain. An endometrial sample can be obtained in about 90% of patients. However, distortion of anatomy from uterine or cervical factors can make the technique a bit more challenging.
Is transvaginal ultrasound part of a surveillance regimen discussed with patients as well?
Transvaginal ultrasound can look at the thickness of an endometrial lining and has been suggested as a tool for surveillance of endometrial cancer in Lynch syndrome patients. Ultrasound, however, has a high false positive rate, especially in premenopausal women, as the endometrial stripe thickness varies throughout the menstrual cycle. Transvaginal ultrasound has been explored as an alternative screening for symptomatic postmenopausal women, where the two have shown to have similar sensitivity. It is not known, however, if the same applies to patients with Lynch syndrome. If transvaginal ultrasound was shown to be as good as endometrial biopsy for women with Lynch syndrome, it would allow for a much less invasive and tolerated means of surveillance.
Is CA-125 a useful test in screening for patients with Lynch syndrome?
Unfortunately, no. Just like transvaginal ultrasound, CA-125 can have false reassuring results as well as false elevations in premenopausal women and therefore is not recommended as a screening tool.
Fortunately, many women are now diagnosed as young adults via cascade testing. For these young women, what are some of the common questions or concerns regarding family planning, and how do you help women navigate these issues?
In general, we work very closely with our colleagues in reproductive endocrinology and infertility to provide important counseling to patients regarding their fertility status as well as options for preservation. Meeting with these specialists once the diagnosis of Lynch syndrome is made can be helpful as many women make decisions about surveillance and preventative surgical options. In addition, discussions regarding assisted reproduction and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis are best done with our REI colleagues so that a patient fully understands the limitations as well as the risks and costs of these technologies.
Do you have any favorite patient-friendly resources, websites, or support groups that your patients have found particularly helpful?
Many of my patients are part of support groups or connect with other patients who have gone through surgery and find that decision process can be helpful. I also recommend the Foundation for Women's Cancers, which can be accessed at http://www.foundationforwomenscancer.org.
Thank you so much for joining us today to review gynecologic malignancy concerns, risk reduction practices, and high-yield counseling topics in our patients with Lynch syndrome. To summarize, risk-reducing hysterectomy and bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy is the most effective management strategy with the goal of endometrial and ovarian cancer prevention. We look forward to emerging data to personalize a patient's risk assessment based on both genotype and family history, especially as more patients without classic Lynch family histories present. Finally, data on screening techniques and the safety of hormone replacement therapy would be extremely helpful to guide patients and assist in joint decision-making. Dr. Garrett, thank you again for your time and expertise. This was a wonderful review of an important topic.
Thank you.
Please stay tuned for our next podcast featuring Dr. Jody Maranchi, a urologist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. She will be discussing urologic cancer risk in Lynch syndrome. Please follow us on Twitter at CGAIGC. If you value this type of educational content, please consider becoming a member of the Collaborative Group of the Americas on Inherited GI Cancer Syndromes. You can get details from our website at www.cgaicc.com.